from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The autonomy votes set for this Sunday in two regions in the eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Lugansk, will take place as scheduled, despite Wednesday's call for a moratorium by Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Legal expert and journalist Alexander Mukouris spoke with RT about the limits of Russian influence over events in Ukraine.
Does Russia have any influence over the actions of the Eastern Self-Defense Forces, after all?
I think it does have influence, but it doesn't have control. And I think this is an absolutely vital point to understand, which some people in the West seem unable to understand. If you look at the reporting that's coming out from the Eastern Ukraine, including from your journalists, there, people like Graham Phillips, they make it absolutely clear that this is a conflict that is in the Ukraine itself and which is being driven by events in the Ukraine. Russia is not behind it. It does not control the people there. It has influence, but not control.
How do you expect Western states to react now here?
I think that some Western states are very negative about this whole proposal that's come out of Moscow yesterday altogether. But generally, I think there will still be efforts by some Western states to pursue negotiations.
Is the decision to go ahead with the vote going to change the situation on the ground? What can we expect?
No, I don't think it's going to change the situation on the ground. A few hours before, we heard Mr. Paruby, who is the head of the Ukraine's National Defense Council, one of the hardliners in Kiev, saying that the anti-terrorist operation, as Kiev calls it, would continue. Given that that was so, and given that there is no real offer of negotiations from Kiev, it was certain that the people in the Donbass would continue with the referendum and that the situation on the ground would continue as before. If there are further moves at an international level to convene a conference which will include the people in the eastern Ukraine, that may change, but that will take some time to happen, and we don't know that it will.
And finally, are the eastern regions capable of carrying out this referendum, do you think?
Well, I've heard that they've managed to print an awful lot of ballot papers, and at the same time, they also appear to have some degree of political control over most of the Donbass, over the eastern regions, the area that's in conflict, and also it seems that they have obtained some kind of electoral lists, not the very latest ones, but earlier ones that were used in the 2012 election. So, yes, I think some kind of referendum will take place. It will not be acknowledged by the West, but no one should have any doubts about the mood in this particular region. Opinion polls, separate from this referendum, show a great deal of alienation from Kiev and from what is happening there in this region. And I think the referendum, however it takes place, will confirm that.
In each case, the ballot simply asks, quote, do you support state autonomy for the National Republic, closed quote, with a choice of yes or no. There is no mention of joining the Russian Federation, although this is a possibility available to the government of the newly autonomous republics should the referendum carry the day. Journalist John White spoke with RT from Edinburgh about the implications of the decision to go ahead with the votes.
Well, I think it's a very brave decision. I think it reflects the fact that they have bled, that they have made great sacrifices, that they have lost loved ones and friends and comrades in the conflict with the Kiev military forces. And it's no surprise for all that. But it does place the Russian government in a rather delicate situation because it is obviously trying to de-escalate the crisis. The President Putin has been very consistent from the outset that he does not want to see the breakup of Ukraine. But obviously he cannot afford to abandon, and clearly he will not abandon, the people in southeast Ukraine who are struggling against this illegal and illegitimate regime in Kiev. But in his speech the other day, he did call for direct negotiations and direct talks between the anti-government protesters in eastern Ukraine and the interim regime or its representatives in Kiev. This is the only way forward. And the planned referendum that are taking place on May 11th in two of the self-proclaimed People's Republics in southeastern Ukraine, they do not necessarily forestall that possibility from happening. So I think that the people who have taken up arms to defend their rights against ultranationalists and avowed fascists in some cases, they are very, very courageous. So we need to see an end to the rhetoric coming from Kiev that they're terrorists, that they're illegitimate in some way. They've actually taken up arms in response to a coup that they toppled a legitimate government.
The referendum is back again. What kind of reaction do you expect from Kiev to this move then?
Well, Kiev, their reaction is written in the blood that they have already spilled in response to their writ being challenged. But, you know, Russia is the only major power involved in this crisis. It's taking active steps to de-escalate the crisis and the conflict. What's needed is similar measures from the EU and from Washington. William Hague recently was in Kiev making a speech supporting the interim regime in Kiev and denouncing Russia's role. That all has to end, because just because President Putin at this stage is calling for the referendum to be put on hold and for a dialogue to take place, that doesn't mean that Russia will not take steps to intervene if the conflict increases and if military forces acting on behalf of the interim regime in Kiev continue to attack civilians in the way that they have been doing.
What about the West? Are they likely to recognize any results of the vote?
No, they can't afford to. They've already taken the path that these people are illegitimate and that this is part of a plot by Russia. One thing that can be refuted from this development is the idea that the anti-government protesters in southeastern Ukraine are acting at the behest of Moscow, that Russia is directing these events in southeastern Ukraine. That's nonsense. And that's proved by the fact that President Putin has called for the referendum to be cancelled and that the people on the ground are deciding to go ahead regardless. So the West has now been exposed as having played this game whereby it's trying to blame Russia for everything that's going on and deny the agency of people on the ground who live in southeastern Ukraine, who are exercising their will and who are acting to restore democratic rights that were violated by the coup in Kiev, which in effect rendered the Ukrainian constitution null and void. It's how we fill that void that is the key thing now.
The West has been calling for Russia to take more action over the crisis, but it appears the anti-Kiev activists in the East aren't listening to Moscow. Who are Western countries likely to turn to next?
Well, they're going to continue to try and put pressure on Russia. They're talking about implementing more sanctions against the Russian government. But, you know, who can they turn to? I think they've already lost this in the court of world opinion. I think what they've done is they've led the people of Western Ukraine, up a hill, promising them a new era of prosperity if they were to move into a Western orbit. And on the contrary, they've brought the country close to civil conflict. So we do need to hear some wise heads coming to the fore. Russia has come out with a very conciliatory statement, and we need to see that reciprocated. Otherwise, this conflict will not end, and we are still risking a very, very serious major conflagration taking place and spreading.
We'll have more on Ukraine later in this newscast. The political turmoil in Thailand shows no sign of abating anytime soon, with pro- and anti-government forces stepping up their activities following the ousting of Prime Minister Yingluck Shinawatra. NHK's Gene Otani has more.
Supporters of Yingluck Shinawatra say they'll take to the streets to protest her dismissal. Opponents of Thailand's ousted prime minister say they'll do the same. She was forced to step down after a court found her guilty of abuse of power. The Constitutional Court says Yingluck illegally interfered in the appointment of the police chief, transferring one of her own relatives to the position. The ruling forced Yingluck and 9 cabinet ministers out of office. Deputy Prime Minister Niwat Tamrong Bunsong Paisan is now the country's acting leader. He plans to discuss with the remaining ministers what steps to take next. They are expected to remain in their posts for the time being. Pro-government supporters have intensified their demonstration against the ruling. They say they'll hold major rallies on Saturday. and anti-government protest leaders demanding the resignation of the administration and political reforms.
A government without a prime minister is no longer a legitimate administration.
Sitep has called for a demonstration on Friday.
In Libya, the chaos continues with the assassination Thursday of another high-ranking official, the head of intelligence in the eastern region of Libya, Colonel Ibrahim Sanusi, was reportedly assassinated Thursday afternoon after his car was shot at near Benghazi's medical college. Sanusi reportedly tried to escape, but was shot again some 100 yards further down the road, this time fatally, according to the Libya Herald. Sanusi was not identified by name, but was introduced as the intelligence chief when he spoke on Libya's Awilan TV 2 days ago. He said terrorist groups were targeting anyone who had been trained abroad since the 2011 takeover of the Libyan government, accusing the group Ansar al-Sharia of being behind much of the violence in the city. Over 80% of voters participated in South Africa's fifth post-apartheid general election and its first since the passing of Nelson Mandela. The ruling African National Congress faced tremendous challenges and growing protests calling for economic emancipation of the poor who remain in the majority in the post-apartheid period. Press TV's Hassan Syria filed this report.
20 years after becoming a democracy, voters have turned out to decide on their future. The choice is broad, ranging from parties which were born during the anti-apartheid struggle to new ones such as the Economic Freedom Fighters, or EFF, who promised to forge a fresh path for the nation.
I believe that EFF is going to bring the change because it's a new party and he's a young man. And you could see him if you see him. You see the leader. He's the real leader.
The Economic Freedom Fighters says it will offer true liberation to South Africa's youth, arguing that the ruling ANC has failed the people. Meanwhile, the official opposition, the Democratic Alliance, contends it is free of corruption and so can bring true change. Analysts, however, believe these elements are all present in the ruling party.
Radicalism is there in parties like the ANC, who are advocating a strong wave of economic transformation if they are re-elected into government, to deal with unemployment, to deal with economic empowerment of those who remain disenfranchised economically.
But for those who have seen the struggle, they believe action is needed urgently.
They just have to pull up their socks because otherwise this country is going to burn. It's a beautiful country and we love it. But people are suffering, you understand what I'm saying?
As voting draws to a close in South Africa's fifth general elections, it's almost a foregone conclusion that the African National Congress will win once more. But how is the big question? Will it be able to maintain its clear majority, or will smaller, newer parties be able to have chipped away at the ruling party's majority? Results are due in the coming days. Hassan Syria, Press TV, Cape Town.
A worker at the Fukushima No. 1 nuclear plant has filed the first lawsuit by an employee against the plant operator TEPCO due to high levels of radiation he was exposed to during the initial days of the plant's 2011 disaster. The claimant says he was unnecessarily exposed to excessively high levels of radiation due to negligence on the part of TEPCO and seeks 11 million yen, or about $110,000, in compensation from the company. The lawsuit was filed Wednesday in Fukushima District Court. During a 2012 interview, he claimed that TEPCO should have known about the high levels of radiation and warned the workers. Last month, 79 U.S. Navy personnel sued TEPCO for a total of $1 billion, alleging that the company lied about the high level of radiation in the area where they were carrying out a humanitarian mission following the tsunami that sparked the nuclear crisis in 2011. The sailors, dozens of whom have suffered cancer, and including one who had a child born with birth defects, claimed they were covered with radiation despite the company's repeated claims that there was no danger. TEPCO, in turn, blamed the U.S. military for the levels of radiation that the naval personnel were exposed to, saying that it was, quote, wholly implausible that military commanders in charge of thousands of personnel and armed with some of the world's most sophisticated equipment relied instead only on the press releases and public statements of a foreign electric utility company, closed quote. Four men from Florida have been arrested in Cuba over a terrorist plot. The country's foreign ministry said in a statement published in the Cuban media outlet Granma Wednesday that the four faced charges of terrorism, saying they, quote, acknowledged that they planned to attack military installations, close quote, and carry out acts of violence. The ministry said three of the accused had made several visits to Cuba to gather intelligence for the plot. The men have been in the Cuban government's custody for 11 days. They were identified as Jose Ortega Amador, Abdulio Rodriguez Gonzalez, Raibel Pacheco Santos, and Felix Monzon. All are Miami residents and reportedly affiliates of Luis Posada Carriles, a former agent of the CIA, who's accused of being the mastermind behind the bombing of Cubana Flight 455, which left 73 civilians dead in 1976, as well as a series of bombing attacks against the Cuban capital, Havana. In response to the ministry's statement, Omar Lopez of the Cuban-American National Foundation in Miami said he did not know the men. Here in the U.S., a House committee approved legislation Wednesday that would place legal restrictions on the NSA's bulk collection of domestic telephone metadata. By a vote of 32-0, the House Judiciary Committee advanced what it calls the USA Freedom Act, which it said would end the NSA's wholesale gathering and storage of American phone data, leaving telecommunications companies responsible for retaining the records. The bill would still allow the NSA to collect the personal phone records, including those of people two contacts away from the person under surveillance, if authorized by a judge on the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, which operates as a rubber stamp for government requests. While the Western media sees the invisible hand of Russia behind the deep discontent in eastern Ukraine with the acting government in Kiev, the rejection by protesters Thursday of Russia's call to cancel this weekend's autonomy referendum was another indication that the discontent is not the creature of Russian manipulation, but real and self-motivated. Investigative journalist Robert Parry is the author of several recent articles challenging the U.S. media narratives on the crisis in Ukraine, including Ukraine's Dr. Strangelove Reality. He spoke with Radio VR's David Cairns about the role that extreme nationalist groups are playing in Ukraine, Kiev's intransigence towards protesters, and the grievances those protesters are airing.
Mr. Perry, let me turn it over to you and ask you what you're getting at when you highlight the reality, this persistent surfacing of neo-Nazi influence in Ukraine.
Well, it's certainly been an important part of the uprising that occurred late last year, early this year, and then culminating in the coup on February 22nd. There were these far-right organizations, some organized under what's called the Right Sector, and this Svoboda Party that has operated largely in Western Ukraine, and they quite openly appeal back to their legacy of fascism and Nazism from World War II. They honor Stepan Bandera, who was a far-right nationalist who collaborated with the Nazis during World War II, and whose paramilitary organization was involved in the expulsion and killing of thousands of Jews and Poles during the war in the 1940s. So you have this history, and many of these very violent organizations have been able to develop and train people and put them in the field. They were sending in hundreds of these trained operatives into Kiev daily in the period before the uprising. So you've had this element, which is quite ugly and which uses Nazi insignias. At one point, when they took over the city hall of Kiev, they hoisted the Confederate battle flag, the sort of universal symbol of white supremacy. And this has been an inconvenient truth that the many of the people who did protest in the Maidan, who had obviously different political interests, have been trying to cover up, and frankly what the U.S. government's been trying to cover up. The key role played by these groups, especially when the protests turned more violent and ultimately seized control of government buildings in mid-late February. So this organization, these groups have not disappeared. And they have continued to play a role in some of the violence. They, because of their of the key role they played in the overthrow of President Yanukovych, the as there was an effort to cobble together a government that was not quite as extreme, they were given four ministries, including national security. And that has been a way for some of these groups then now to be incorporated into the National Guard and into some of these police forces, and they're being sent to the front lines. According to the National Security Chief Parubuy, some of these folks were dispatched to eastern Ukraine to help put down the uprisings there. So, and some apparently appeared also in the recent tragedy in Odessa. So you have this this element that is the most determined, the most violent of the pro-coup forces, and they continue to play a key role.
Does it seem to you, therefore, that this Dr. Strangelove reality is a danger which will persist, and is there any hope that the West, the world community, will recognize it?
Well, I think it will persist. These groups seem to be very well organized and very determined. They are, in some ways, the most motivated in terms of the use of violence of any of the groups. And we've seen something comparable in a place like Syria, for instance, where you had a more moderate opposition to the Assad regime, but ultimately the most aggressive fighters against the Assad regime were the Islamists and some associated with al-Qaeda. And I think you can what you're seeing is the use of these very hardline people who are inclined to fight and eager to fight now being necessary in a way by the current government, the interim government in Kiev, to defend itself and to go and battle the people who have risen up against the overthrow of Yanukovych. So I think, yes, it will persist. And I think what this has done is also generate on the other side a feeling of anger, being disenfranchised. Yanukovych had his political base in the eastern part of Ukraine. And once he was overthrown and once the constitutional process was violated, then people in other places who had their own interests and felt their interests were being trampled on, understandably, resisted this, and because of the efforts to put down these takeovers of buildings in the east, in which the Kiev government termed these terrorists, they claimed they were doing anti-terrorist operations. That only further feeds this fire of violence, because once people are deemed terrorists, that has certain implications in terms of how they're going to be approached. They're going to be essentially taken out and killed. So that makes people in those areas more inclined to get armed and to defend themselves.
I think it follows from what you're telling us that it would be a bit of a stretch to impose responsibility currently on the neo-Nazi elements in Ukrainian politics for the intransigence of the regime towards negotiating with the protesters in the east. In other words, if the entire government has already labeled them terrorists, has begun anti-terrorist operations, if they've already sort of drawn a line in the sand, they won't negotiate with them. It's really not the neo-Nazis in the cabinet or elsewhere that are driving that train, right? I mean, maybe they've set it up this way, but it's already out of the hands. It's not as though we can remove a couple of members from the cabinet as a gesture and all of a sudden find conciliation between the two sides, that the entire Kiev regime is at this point taking a stance which is intransigent. Have I got that right, or are we not sure?
Well, it seems that way. I would assume that there are some elements of the Kiev government who are less eager to see this thing boil up into a civil war than others. We've seen Prime Minister Yatsenyuk make some gestures toward reconciliation in saying that there will not be efforts to discriminate against people using the Russian language and so forth. But in terms of what they've articulated, it's all been pretty much from the same script, that these uprisings in the East have to be put down. But I'm sure there are gradations within any political coalition like there is now in Kiev, where some are harder line than others. Some really want this fight, and some may wish they could find a way to somehow reach some accommodation. The problem also has been, though, that in the United States, both the State Department and much of the mainstream media, I guess virtually the entire mainstream media, has been just pouring fuel on the fire, using the most extreme language, taking the most extreme interpretations of events, assuming, for instance, that the fighters in the East were simply Russian agents who had been slipped across the border to stir up trouble, rather than indigenous forces who have their own desires to control their destiny. So you've had this essentially false narrative that's been created in the United States, and that has further inflamed matters. To some degree, the EU has gone along with this. There's been a bit more nuance, I think, in the EU position than the U.S. position, but still, there is this. There's not been an effort to apply objective, even-handed analysis to the current crisis, at least not in Washington, D.C., where I operate.
Isn't it the case that there's an economic element that Ukraine is, in some sense, could be seen as a sinking ship, and that's part of the concern of not only Eastern Ukrainians, but Ukrainians elsewhere?
Well, yes. I think I think what you've seen in Ukraine going back to 1991 and the collapse of the Soviet Union was the emergence or the use of what's known as shock therapy, this extreme free market capitalism, which was applied both to Russia and other parts of the old Soviet Union, including Ukraine. And that led to the emergence of a handful of oligarchs, 10 or 12 oligarchs in Ukraine, who are extremely rich and control a great deal of the wealth and therefore the political power as well. In Russia, that trend was interrupted by the rise of Vladimir Putin, who, for all the reasons you may criticize him, was also a strong leader and took on some of the oligarchs and tried to make the economic and political system of Russia work better for the country as a whole. That did not happen in Ukraine. And that's one of the reasons why there's this extraordinary corruption and why you have such widespread poverty and unemployment, whereas you have a handful of people who control so much of the wealth. Now, that has led to a lot of dissent, and understandably so, among the population. And when the EU dangled this idea that maybe Ukraine could become part of the EU in some way, they also raised those expectations probably too far. And that was followed by the IMF coming in and saying, well, as your first step, you're going to have to accept all these really harsh macroeconomic, quote, reforms, unquote, which means making the lives of the Ukrainians, the lives that are already very hard, even harder. And that was one of the reasons Yanukovych backed away from the deal with the EU. And as soon as the coup occurred and the Yatsuna government was put in, he was essentially handpicked by the Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland. And once one of the first things he did was to push through the IMF requirements, this harsh austerity program. So that's been a factor for some of the Ukrainians, especially in the East, who do not want to see this kind of harsh, even harsher life being foisted upon them. And as well, if they are cut off from Russia, which is their primary commercial partner, their lives will be even harder still. So there's some very logical reasons why people would rise up. And in fact, when there have been a few occasions where American journalists have done their job properly and gone in and actually interviewed people in eastern Ukraine, what the reporters found was that there are these indigenous concerns, not that Moscow's pulling the strings, but that these people have real political grievances and real political and economic fears.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.